This is 4:55 on Monday, September 13th.
Good morning. So, just put up the calendar to remind us of what's going on, myself as well as everybody else. The exam, first exam is a week from today. We seem to be sort of well ahead of schedule on this chapter, and I'm not quite sure why. I feel like I've gone over everything I expected to go over, but it also seems like it has gone by faster than in previous years. So I don't know what has happened there. Maybe I just added some extra time in making up the schedule. I don't know. Anyway, so today we're going to do congestion control, which is what was scheduled for Friday, but we're going to do a full day of it. So we certainly will need to do exam review and sample exam on Friday. But I think on Wednesday we'll go ahead and start Chapter 4. But Chapter 4 will not be on the exam. So the exam will just be through Chapter 3. That's what I expect. We'll see how congestion control goes today. Other things, the Chapter 3 assignment, remember the problem set is due on Friday, but if you turn it in sooner, Hawk said that he would try to look at it sooner. He'll monitor the Dropbox and get you feedback. So if you turn it in at midnight on Friday, you may not get feedback until Sunday or something. If you'd like it sooner, turn it in sooner. For the purpose of study. How is the project going? Like, at all? Anybody? Done? Okay. What?
The real question is, how many is started?
Well, that's sort of what I was getting at, is any progress at all. It's still a ways away for the due date. Okay. Anything else? Friday, I did not push the start button on the audio. Wednesday, there is audio, but for some reason it's not showing up, which I'll have to look into. And I did push the start button today. Yes?
Is there a place that we can find solutions for the homeworks?
It is the case that solutions to the homework are widely available on the internet. Unfortunately, for some purposes, and fortunately for others. Okay, you remember that though they're not to be used in producing what you turn in. But okay. I guess that's all. Yeah. Other questions? Comments? So we ended last time talking about how TCP connections get established with the so-called three-way handshake that involves a SYN packet, that is a packet with the SYN bit, status bit set in the header, being sent from the client to the server responding with a so-called SYN ACK packet, which has both the SYN bit set and the ACK bit set. And after that, then we're just using the ACK bit in the ongoing data stream. Three-way handshake, 1, 2, and then data flows. The data can flow with this packet. And it can be expressed as a state machine. Surprise. Okay. Closing a connection, we face similar problems that we had with establishing the connection of making sure that the right thing happens regardless of what gets lost in the way of packets. And so there's a closing the connection handshake, that also goes on. And what's interesting about this is that, remember, we have with a TCP connection, we have data flowing in both directions, right? We have data and ACKs going in both directions. You can close half of a TCP connection. One side can say, I'm done, I'm not going to send anymore. But the other side could go on sending. It's sort of interesting. But there's a protocol for closing connections as well, that involves the FIN bit, F-I-N. Remember, that's another header bit. Again, you set it all by itself. It gets acknowledged as if it took up a byte in the data stream. And finally, the other side closes its connection. Now, part of the problem here is that suppose that these acknowledgments get lost in the process, then the person who sent the FIN will not hear that the connection has been closed. So there are some timers that have to be set, and the participant will actually sort of force close the connection after a certain amount of time. And if you look in, let's escape out of here and go to one of these things and say, well, okay. So the command is netstat. And the flag that you want to pass to it is dash A. In order to get a list of all the connections that a machine has, and this works, it's the same command in Windows and Unix land, which is interesting. And it will tell you about the state of each port, essentially, that is existing in the machine. And you see here that many of them are listening ports. This is the port number. The local address 0 here means on any interface. So all of these are TCP listening ports. Remember that in order to actually communicate with somebody, they have to make a connect request to that port, which will correspond to an accept system call, and after that happens, they move into this. Doesn't scroll very well. The TCP connections move into this established state, and you see those. But sometimes, if you're really active, like browsing on the internet, where you're making a lot of connections and they're going away, you will actually see the state here being fin wait or fin wait 2, which means that we're waiting for the other side to close the connection, okay, or to our close to be acknowledged. These other ones down here. This is interesting. I hadn't really looked at this beforehand, but these are IP version 6 versions of the same protocols that are running up above on IPv4, and they're also listening. This is the format that IPv6 addresses are printed in, and we'll talk about IPv6 later when we talk about Chapter 4. And then come all the UDP stuff. Similarly, oh, here's a real IPv6 address that's not a wild card. Okay. Fun stuff. Anyway, if you want to know what's going on in your inside your machine as far as networking goes, netstat is the command to learn. The dash A flag says anything, tell me all about it. And I also passed the dash N flag to say don't look up IP addresses in DNS. It just makes it run faster. And sometimes you want to have it do that, but other times not. Okay? We did this. So, in some ways, I think that all that stuff about the details of TCP and the headers and the fins and sins and acts are really important, even for application programmers to know. But they're also kind of boring in some ways. It's really hard to make them exciting. They're important details that you sort of need to study and look up and learn, but there isn't a lot of interest around them unless we were to go into very careful analysis of the startup and finishing protocols, for example. And that's not really the purpose of this class. So if you take the 555 class, the graduate version of the class, sometimes the way it's taught, we sort of go deeply into those finite state machines and why they are what they are and how you verify that they work correctly. But sort of at this initial take level, I don't think that's appropriate use of time. On the other hand, if you ever find yourself in the position of actually having to implement TCP, then you will want to study those finite state machines very carefully, and also you'll want to study the literature to understand all the mistakes people have made in implementing them. And also they leave some choices open, and there are some mistakes that can be made in making those choices as well. So you can conform to the state machines and still not have a very good TCP implementation. So if you ever find yourself in an embedded systems operation where you have to build TCP from scratch, probably not too many people do that today. There are commercial implementations you can buy as libraries. You may get involved in that, but my guess is probably not, unless you sort of get into working for Cisco or something like that. Okay, so we will move on from the incredibly detailed, important, but boring stuff to something that is less detailed and pretty interesting, to my way of thinking. So congestion is when there is too much data being sent into the network for the network to handle. And it's important to remember that congestion control is not the same thing as flow control. What is flow control? What is the purpose of flow control? When the receiver can't handle the data that the sender is sending. Okay? That's the purpose of flow control. Is the receiver manages its flow control window to say to the sender, don't send me more data than I can take. Right? Then we'll fit in my buffers. But congestion control is about not going faster than the network can go. And that has to do both with the sort of raw capacity of the network and also what other people are currently doing to the network at the current time. Okay, so congestion occurs when the network has too much work to do than it has more work to do than it can do, and it shows up as lost packets and long delays, having to do with either running out of buffers somewhere or having big buffers that are full. Okay, so congestion is one of the big worries about all networking, and in the internet certain things are done, and on other networks other things are done. Okay, so let's just look at how this goes. We're going to dig a bit into how these things affect actual performance and what goes on. So we're going to assume that there are two senders and two receivers sharing a link in between. That the output link here is rate limited with capacity R, and we'll start out by assuming that there's no retransmission. Okay? So if there's no retransmission, then what happens is, and there's no retransmission and there are unlimited shared buffers. In that case, what happens as the lambda in, which is the rate at which this guy, these guys are sending, as it goes up, you eventually get to the point where it reaches half the capacity of the output link, and at that point, you can't go anymore, right? Because each of them is using R over 2, and things, and that's where you're stuck. But as we saw before, as the load on a link approaches, or the utilization of a link approaches 1, the queuing for that link will tend to go to infinity. So the delays of all these packets get longer and longer as you get closer and closer to the capacity of the link. Okay? That's in the case when we have as many buffers as we need. There's no packet loss. Okay, so suppose now that we're a little bit more realistic and there is a limit on how much buffering we can do. We'll just assume that both of these things go at the same rate all the time. Now we're going to distinguish between the rate at which the application layer sends data and the rate at which the transport layer sends data. Because in this case, sometimes packets that have been sent once will be sent again for retransmission. So lambda prime in is going to be greater than or equal to lambda in. And we ask ourselves, what is the output rate here? Anybody want to conjecture what the output rate is? What does your intuition tell you it ought to be? Yeah. It's going to be the same as the application that's sending, that it's essentially it's going to be R over 2 again. Because in this case, although we may have timeouts, every packet that goes across this link is useful. Right? Packets that there may be packets sent in here that are not useful because they get dropped, but every packet that survives to be sent across this link is useful. And so you go at the full rate of the link. So the first case is that the sender only sends when buffer space is available, and in that case, what happens? Oh, yeah. Do I want to do my animation? Why not? Yes, there's space, it goes through, that's fine. And things look just as before. if packets can be lost and the sender knows exactly about their loss, and maybe it gets thrown away, but that was the second go, I guess. But in this case is what we've talked about, that we drop things but only going in, and we know about it, then eventually, although we have to send faster than R over 2 to make up for the fact that some of these packets are being lost, eventually we can reach the R over 2 capacity of the link. Okay? But the realistic situation is that the sender doesn't know whether packets have been lost or not, right? With TCP, things can get delivered after the time, you can get an ACK back after the timeout occurred. And in that case, you end up using the link. I just need to click more slowly. So there's free buffer space and all is well and good. But it gets slowed down and times out, and yeah, okay. So in that case, notice that we used 2 packets worth of capacity on this link in order to deliver 1 packet worth of so-called good put. Good put is throughput is sort of how much data per second you send over the link. Good put is how much of it is useful. In that case, we end up achieving less than R over 2 capacity because some of the capacity is being used for things that have to be thrown away. All right. Well, that's okay. That picture doesn't look too bad. In the book, the little section on this assigns sort of very specific levels to what's achievable here. Like it says R over 3 here, and then another picture says R over 4. They're just making those numbers up. There's nothing there's nothing fundamental about R over 4 and R over 3 in this situation. They just sort of said if certain things, you know, it might be the case that you achieve R over 3. Well, I wish they hadn't done that. This is a better picture. It just shows that the good put is lower than the throughput due to lost packets. Okay, so more work for a given good put and unneeded retransmissions means that the link, the output link of the router carries multiple copies, thereby decreasing the good put. And it's not just that the sender has to retransmit here. It's that the sender is using capacity on the upstream link. You know what I mean by the upstream link? This link, the upstream of the congested link, this is called the upstream link. And so capacity here is being used as well in a wasteful way when congestion causes duplications there. All right. So this scenario is more interesting still. And it involves it shows what happens when you have multiple senders with different access to a given link sending on that link, and you increase the speed of the sending, and you ask what happens in this case. So notice that host A here is sending to host C, and host D, how are we going to do this? Host B, I have to look ahead to see which one we're going to study here. Well, I guess it doesn't matter. So host A is sending, host A is sending to host C. Host D is sending to host B, the blue line. Similar things are happening sort of elsewhere in this network. And the important thing to see is that host A has access directly to this router, say at high speed. Host D, the blue connection, has access to this router only after its data comes through here. Okay? So, host D has access to this router only after its data comes through here, and right. Okay, I think that's all we need. So now let's consider what happens. Host D can send sort of arbitrarily fast to this location, but its packets get shared with what's coming from host C, so it gets slowed down. Okay? By that, host A can go sort of arbitrarily fast because it has direct access, and so it can sort of overwhelm what host D can send here. So when a buffer comes free here, who's going to get it? Most likely host A, because he can send much faster. He can send much faster. And so so as things evolve in this network, what happens is that everybody's throughput, well, if you just look at the DAB part, what's happening is that host D's throughput will go to zero, essentially. Host A's to C will be high. It will be limited by both this and this. But if you make this into a loop like you've got here, the same thing is happening to everybody. Right, everybody can go arbitrarily fast on their input to the first router, but are limited by what happens on the second router of their connection. And so what you get is that as the lambda n prime increases up to the capacity, now I don't know why C instead of R, increases up to R over 2, lambda out actually goes down for everybody. And this is sort of what makes congestion control interesting, is that what's the name for this phenomenon? We've mentioned it several times. Bob mentioned it. Bob Braden mentioned it when he was here. You remember that? Well, this is sort of not congested. This is congestion, and this is congestion collapse, right? Because we're working really hard. We're sending a lot of data into the network, but none is actually coming out, or very little is coming out. So that's a congestion collapse, and it occurs because we waste the upstream capacity of the link upstream of where we links upstream of where the congestion occurs. And in a real network where you have things in cycles, everything is upstream of something else, right? And so you end up wasting the bandwidth of all the critical links, and congestion collapse occurs. Okay, so this we've got to avoid. As we talked about, it actually occurred in the NSFNet in the late 1980s. There was a situation in which congestion collapse occurred. They basically had to shut everything down and start over again because there was no recovery from it. So two ways of doing it. One is what's called end-to-end, in which the endpoints, in our case of the internet, TCP endpoints, sort of take care of slowing themselves down when congestion is occurring. And then there's network-assisted, in which the routers provide some form of feedback to the senders to tell them to slow down. And it can be either just an indication that congestion is occurring, or you could have a reservation or a command to send at a specific rate. So ATM is another networking technology beside TCP/IP. It uses what are called resource management cells to indicate congestion, and what happens is that, what happens is that a sender sends some packets that contain data, and others are called resource management packets or cells. And when things are congested, the routers sort of flip bits in those resource management cells to say things are congested. The receiver, right, these are sort of forward-going cells, the receiver reflects those back to the sender and sends them back to the sender, and therefore the sender eventually learns that there's congestion going on and knows to slow down. But eventually here is much faster than in the schemes that we'll see here in a second, because congestion is explicitly indicated at some point on the forward path and then reflected back to the sender on the reverse path, and you learn about that within one round trip time, right? That's all it takes. Less than one round trip time, depending on where the congestion happens. So resource management cells and data cells. You said it. This is a really lousy figure. Sorry. It doesn't show anything. Okay. Well, anyway, you would set a bit in one of these things. It would get here, and it would get turned around and come back here. Sorry. Okay, so how does it work in TCP, where we don't have support from the IP network? TCP detects congestion by the occurrence of missing acknowledgments, essentially dropped packets. And the fundamental rule that was discovered after the congestion collapse of the NSFNet is that it is necessary to, when congestion is indicated, to cut the congestion window in half. That's the important thing, that you severely decrease the congestion window when congestion occurs, and you delicately approach the point of congestion, which leads to this so-called additive increase multiplicative decrease rule, which gives you a congestion window size behavior that looks like this, roughly. Okay, so additive increase, you go up slowly, and when loss is detected, you go down by a lot. And so you're constantly probing the capacity of the link. And you have to constantly probe it, of course, because the traffic around you over the path that you're communicating is also changing. And so then you will ask yourself, so everybody's doing this. We've got a whole bunch of people doing this behavior. What happens? Is it stable? Or do some people get lots of bandwidth and other people get only a little bit? We'll go into that question in a moment. So just like the flow control window, the congestion window limits how far ahead of the acknowledgments the sender is willing to get. So this is our congestion window. This is how many we've sent that are not yet acknowledged. These are ones that we have sent that we could send, but haven't sent yet. And the green ones are ones that have already been acknowledged. So the picture looks very much like the picture for the flow control window. But this is the congestion window. So, next question. What is the rule that the sender actually obeys for whether it can send this packet or not? Well, for the congestion window purpose, the answer is here. But that's only half the answer, right? The other part of the answer comes from the flow control window. If it's not allowed to send it by the flow control window, it doesn't do that either. It doesn't send it either. It takes the minimum of those two things. All right. So the congestion window varies as congestion occurs. And if you think about it a little bit more, you'll see that the rate that you send is approximately the congestion window over the round trip time. Why is that? Well, because every time every time you get an acknowledgement, you essentially can send another packet. And how does this argument go? Oh, well, if you think of them as being bunched up, it's clear. Because you sort of burst out all of this data as fast as you can, and then sometime later, one round trip time later, if there's no congestion, you get back all the X for those. That's the easy way to say that. And it's only approximate, right? Because if there is congestion, things will slow down. Okay. So, how do you get started on this path? Where do you start? Well, in the early days of TCP, you picked the receiver's flow control window as your initial congestion window, and you would blast out that many packets. Okay? Which meant that on your initial transmission, you weren't paying any attention to congestion at all. Okay? This turned out to be a bad thing. So what they did was they said, we have to slow down the startup of TCP, but we don't want to slow it down too much, because if we slowed it down to the point of, you know, only increasing by a little bit at a time, like in this picture, I mean, if you really could get up to there, then it would take you a very long time to get there, right? If you had to start from one. So what they said was, we're going to define a slow start algorithm that exponentially increases the rate. Now, usually we don't think of exponential things that go exponentially faster at every step as being slow, right? That's not the usual association of that terminology. But it's slower than the original version that said blast everything at once. Okay? So slow start is actually faster than additive increase, that comes later, but it's slower than blast everything at once. And the way it works is that basically every round trip time you double the number of you double the congestion window. Okay? And you do that by every time you get an acknowledgement being willing to send two more packets. Okay? So that's slow start. And then the next thing is, how do we implement that sawtooth behavior? Well, if a timeout occurs, the congestion window is reset back down to one maximum segment size, which is about 1,500 bytes typically, and then use the slow start algorithm to grow it for a while. We'll have to answer what a while is. And if you get three duplicate acts for a particular packet, then in the current version, which is called TCP Reno, you cut the congestion window in half and then grow linearly from there. Okay, so TCP Tahoe, which is the older version, always sets the congestion window to one. Okay, regardless of whether it was detected by a timeout or an ACK. Okay, so then the question is, when should we stop using slow start and start using additive increase? And the rule is that you grow up to this threshold. How to set it remains an issue. You grow up to the threshold and then use additive increase after that. How did it get set initially? I think that answer is on a later slide. What is it? Where does this come from? Okay, so with TCP Tahoe, you set the threshold to half of the congestion window at the time when the loss was occurred, and then grow linearly from there. All right. Okay, so there's this lovely finite state machine representation that tells that whole story. This is in the book. I believe that there is one mistake now on this one. There were multiple mistakes in the previous edition of the book, but it looks to me like there's one mistake here, which is that what is this transition? Oh, yes, when we have three duplicate acts, which is an indicator of congestion, sort of a mild indicator of congestion, it's mild because it indicates that the network is still delivering data, right? Your duplicate acts occur when you get some data. So the network is still delivering data. You get three of those, you take it as an indication of congestion, you cut the threshold in half, and you set the current window to be the threshold plus 3 MSS, 3 times MSS bytes. It's not 3, not 3 bytes, 3 times MSS. Why is it plus 3? Because those three packets, those three duplicate acts that you got, all came after the event that caused the packet loss, whatever it was. Okay? So they're sort of in the next round already. And so you treat them as if they occurred after the loss, and so you get to add them in here. Right, that's cool. There was something else. Oh, there's a plus 3 here that I think is bogus as well. Oh, yes. The initial threshold is 64 kilobytes. Why? I don't know. and whether that's still appropriate at in an internet that has big capacity. Again, I don't know. They don't talk about that. Okay? So that's sort of the state machine for the congestion window, and remember then that it's the minimum of the congestion window and the flow control window that actually governs what can be sent. I typically ask a question on the exam that has to do with that fact. Timeouts. I don't know. Okay, so how much throughput can TCP actually achieve? We have, if you just look at the sort of raw additive increase multiple get decrease thing without the slow start pieces, you see that we oscillate between the capacity and half the capacity, and if you average over that, you see that it's 3/4 of the actual capacity. Other problems with this scheme have to do with so-called long fat pipes. Long pipes are ones that have long round trip times, and fat pipes are ones that have large capacity. And it turns out that you need to have a lot of packets in flight on those, as you would guess from our bandwidth delay product analysis earlier. It turns out that you can analyze the throughput, the TCP throughput, in terms of how much loss you incur, and if you look at all of this, you see that in order to achieve a very good throughput, you need essentially no losses, and that's pretty unrealistic. So people are studying what to do to TCP to make it work better over these pipes. Now, mostly we don't have to deal with very long fat pipes. 100 millisecond round trip time is actually generous for most pipes that are fat. But if you want to go to the moon, for example, or even to Mars, long and fat get sort of... what should we say? You don't have to be very fat going all the way to Mars to have real issues about using something like TCP over that sort of distance. Okay, so we will have to talk about fairness next time. The question is, this comes back to this, okay, so you've got everybody sort of probing the network and backing off when congestion is congestion is detected, what happens? Does somebody win and somebody lose, or does everybody win? And we'll look at that next time. Okay, and then we'll start into chapter 4, I'm sure. Okay, that's it, and we'll look at a sample exam on Friday.